Welcome to Leaders Under Fire in Sports, brought to you by Culture in Sports. This is where leadership decisions, organizational culture, media pressure, and legal realities collide. Your hosts are legal expert Bob Boland, myself, crisis communication specialist Jeff Chatterton, and with leadership and culture expert Dr. Jeremy Piasecki. Together with our special guests, we break down the moments that put sports leaders under the microscope and what it really takes to respond with integrity, accountability, and impact. This is the Leaders Under Fire in Sports.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Bob Boland. Welcome back to Leaders Under Fire in Sports. I'm joined by our usual cohorts, Jeff Chatterton, the crisis communicator, and ultimate savant of all things crisis and communication. Jeremy Piasecki, the person who puts cultures back together and our leader here at Culture and Sports. And today we're joined by a special guest, somebody I've long admired. Ken Davidoff was for a long time the best and most hard-hitting baseball columnist in New York. He did the most powerful work. He turned it out daily on deadline. And it mattered in the world of doing that. He's here with a new book, though, and that's one of our reasons for talking to Ken today. But we'll also talk a little bit about his transition and his career. We'll talk a little bit about the state of athletics right now, because I think his new book serves it well. We may get him to talk a little bit about the state of leadership in baseball, going back a ways and going forward. But we're excited to be joined by Ken today, and this was very much my idea when I saw him. I saw him do a TV interview about this book. The book is a great one, and for somebody who, in one of his two day jobs, had parents make up a video, essentially doctor it, to try to get a coach suspended for events that didn't really happen the way they said. This is a timely topic to talk about how to manage playing the game within the rules and within the spirit of the game. And I think we grew up, I'm the oldest on the panel by a little bit, which is an unusual circumstance in the circles I hang out in, but a unique time to be talking about being a sport, honoring the game and play. And there's probably no game other than baseball that teaches us those rules or as well as they do. So Ken, welcome. Thanks for joining us. And we're thrilled to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here, Bob. And thanks for having me.
Ken, Tell us a little bit about the book. It's a stunning one, and your purpose in writing it.
Sure. So the book is called 101 Lessons from the Dugout. It is co-written by Carly Rotbart, who is a longtime parenting expert and retired pediatrician. And as per the title, we break it down to 101 small chapters, one or two pages each. And in each chapter, we discuss one element of baseball and softball, and what are the takeaways from those elements? You know, what can you learn on the field and then apply it off the field? So maybe we'll get into a few examples, but I'll just give you the basic one. Chapter 2, the starting lineup. You know, what happens when you're not in the starting lineup? You come to the field and you're not in the lineup. You know, how do you respond to that news? Do you let it ruin your day? Do you put your head down and drag yourself into oblivion? Or do you stand up and fight and say, I'm going to be the best substitute player I can and win more playing time for the next time, and then translate that to the rest of your life, particularly as a young person? You know, if you try out for the school play and you don't get the lead role, but you get the role with two lines, you know, you're going to crush those two lines and try to win more stage time the next time. So that's the basic premise of the book.
Had the opportunity to read the book, I loved it. It's an easy read, I gotta admit. you can plow through it in an evening. It really is 101 lessons, and they're about a page and a half each. They're bite-sized pieces. do you have a favorite? Do you have one that really sticks out to you?
I do, Jeff, and it's chapter 23, Small Ball, One Step at a Time, because I feel like I applied that to my career. Now, I think we all know small ball in the context of baseball and softball. Don't swing for the fences, move the runners over, a single, a sacrifice bunt, a ground ball to the right side, and a, and a, and a sacrifice fly, if you, although that exact sequence wouldn't work, but you get the idea. just move, keep focus on moving the runners over, as opposed to trying to go deep. And I applied that to my career as a journalist. You know, when I first started covering Major League Baseball in 1995, I certainly was not swinging for the fences. I wasn't trying to break any bombshell trades or write any inflammatory columns. I was just trying to meet people and get my arms around the lay of the land and started off small like that and worked my way up to where I could swing for the fences and write a big column or break big news.
Now, Ken, would you say that you played small ball into transitioning into writing this book? Because have you written books before, or was this your first opportunity at writing a book? And did you feel like getting the runners into the next position was more important than trying to hit it out of the park?
That's interesting. Wow, I never thought of it that way, Jeremy. But yeah, this was the first book I successfully published. I did have other opportunities and swung and missed, to keep the metaphors going here. But yeah, for sure, like this book, I like, you know, like my name is listed second on the book, deservedly so, because Harley Ropart, this book is really his baby. You know, he came up with the concept of translating the baseball lessons into life lessons, and then invited me to be his collaborator so we could blend our two perspectives. But yeah, I wasn't in this book. It's not a bombshell. As Jeff indicated, it's family friendly, bite sized, and it's more comfort food than an inflammatory book.
Ken, it fits so well with what our message is. And even though we're dealing a lot of times with leaders in crisis, and there's certainly no shortage of them in sports anywhere on any given day, so much of what Culture in Sports is about, our host, is about building positive culture that makes sports better, makes our games better, makes us better people. And not all of us are going to run a 9-8-300, or we're not going to hit 300 nor 50 home runs or whatever athletic skill we weren't gifted in, but there's a place for us in the firmament of sport. What was it that drove you to kind of collaborate on this, but also why wasn't it relevant to you? What made it jump out to you as a topic based on what you're seeing today?
Well, I have to be honest, Bob, it wasn't my incentive in initially joining this project was less on what I was seeing today and more on my own internal story. You know, I wrote hardcore about baseball, as you indicated, Bob, for a good 25 years, and I was burned out. You know, I could not write one more column about what's wrong with the Yankees. You know, they've lost 5 of 7. What's the problem? You know, I couldn't cover one more Major League Baseball owners meetings and ask questions about steroids and collective bargaining. So the opportunity to write this sweet, family-friendly, positive book about the love of the game and all the joy that it brings to people and all the good that it brings to people was such a curveball for me to be the obnoxious with my metaphors, you know, that, and I, that's why I was really excited to work on it. And then you're right. As per your question, there has been this benefit. Like, I do feel like our book is meeting the moment as we talk about the evolution of youth sports in particular, but also, big time sports, you know, just reinforcing the message that the goal of these games, yes, of course you play to win, but you can also win in different ways. You know, it's not only about the scoreboard.
There's an element of failure built into stick and ball games, isn't there?
Sure.
That's unique. If I were an offensive lineman and I made 33% of my blocks, I'd be benched pretty quickly. And right. I did, just about. in fairness, though, there is that element of failure in the stick and ball games. And you aimed it at lessons from the diamond, lessons from the dugout, lessons from bats and balls, and that's a unique thing. As I've traveled and dealt with investigations in sport or dealt with people in sports, there's a unique added element to baseball and softball in that way, isn't there?
Oh, there sure is, Bob. Yeah, Chapter 88, averages, excellent doesn't mean perfect, and that's where we address what you just said. You know, the best hitters fail 7 out of 10 times. And just dealing with that. Now, as you said, offense, that doesn't work for offensive linemen, doesn't work for neurosurgeons for that matter. But credit goes to Scott Simon for that line. He came up with that when he interviewed me. Bottom line is, again, addressing our younger audience, Yeah, even if you fail one test, like it's okay. It's the average that counts, you know. So if you have a bunch of other A's, the F isn't going to drag it down too badly. And it's important to keep your, you know, to not get too upset over one failure, the ratio, depending on the arena, because it's all about the average.
We call this particular podcast Leaders Under Fire. And we'd like to say it's all about the leadership decisions that get made off the field. Now you've spent 30 years. You chased Steinbrenner through hallways. You've seen A-Rod at his best and at his worst. Sit back and take you know, so Bob's the lawyer, Jeremy's the culture guy, I'm the crisis guy, right? Sit back and is there something that really kind of sits with you? You know, some sort of really crazy moment, some leadership decision that you've seen that just kind of like, wow, that is something everyone needs to think about and to incorporate.
Wow, that's a great question, Jeff. And it's, well, I'll talk it through with you guys, and maybe together we can figure out the lesson. Because the biggest, the most crazy moment of my career that immediately comes to mind. So if you all can go back far enough to Hideki Arabu, Yankees pitcher, and he really struggled. Sadly, he killed himself later, but he was a he really struggled with Major League Baseball after coming from Japan. But so it was the last game of spring training, you know, what we call you know, the day you break camp, right? You pack up all the equipment and you say goodbye to Florida, and on we go to our journey. And the Yankees were flying from Tampa to Los Angeles for a couple of exhibition games with the Dodgers at Dodger Stadium. Then it was from there to Oakland to play the A's up in Oakland for the start of the season. So Arabu was one out away from finishing his stint, but he had gotten in trouble for not covering first base on ground balls to the right side. And lo and behold, the very last batter, Cleveland Indians, hits a ground ball to the right side. Arabu just stands there, does not cover first base. And oh my God, crisis. I remember all the media, we sprinted out of the press box and went to find the boss, George Steinbrenner, who proceeded to reward us by calling Hideki Arabu a fat pussy toad. You know, major, major headlines. And then what happens is Arabu goes into the manager's office, and it was interim manager Don Zimmer. Joe Torre was getting treated for prostate cancer at the time. So interim manager Don Zimmer, then Steinbrenner comes in, and Hideki Arabu tells these two men through his interpreter, "I'm not ready to break camp. I don't want to be with the team." And so they spent hours trying to convince him to join the team. The rest of the Yankees players are just sitting at their lockers, just kind of like shrugging and laughing. And like, you know, they're waiting to board the team plane to LA. And they're being held up by Hideki Arabu. Finally, Bernie Williams ordered a bunch of pizzas for everybody. And or so like, and like, God bless them. Back nowadays, they would have kicked the media out. But back then, we're just standing there with the players, like, well, this is crazy. And I think ultimately Steinbrenner did take charge of the situation and said, all right, you can stay here. Like, we'll find someone else to take your spot on the roster, and you know, we'll have you work with our pitching people and figure this out. So yeah, maybe not a concrete leadership lesson, but ultimately George did take control of the situation by saying, look, we have 24 other players who have a plane to catch. So if you're going to do this, as upsetting as this is, we'll deal with it, but everyone else has to go.
I don't know, it even rack that adaptability, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say there was some
Well,
adaptability
but
there.
again, I mean, was it the pitcher who is not adaptable at this point, or was it the like leadership element of the organization? I mean, first they started with name calling, and then they were trying to force a pitcher who was probably self-reflecting and saying, "Hey, I am not ready to move on with the team." Do you think that maybe the leadership made, obviously with the name calling, they made a bad choice. But do you think that they continue to make bad choices until they really listened to what it was the pitcher was saying, and then they were able to transition and do the right thing?
I think that's fair, Jeremy. I'm not even sure if Arabu knew about the fat pussy toad quote. I'm not like I, you know, he probably did. He probably did.
Well, even if not in the moment, at some point he heard about it.
We probably told him. Yeah, we probably told him now that I think about it. But yeah, no, I think that's an accurate capturing of the situation.
I'm only laughing because the Arabu story sort of tells us everything that's wrong with the business of sports at times. And for somebody who more or less practices the business of sport or has taught the business of sport, or worse yet, the law of sport, which helps define and frame the business of sport, sometimes it does get in the way of the joy of the game, the idea that the values, the joy, the simple pleasure of that. Since I didn't usually work in baseball, I got to enjoy baseball during a lot of the time you wrote. Now I sometimes work in baseball, and I enjoy that about just as little as I enjoy the rest now. And you talked about your own deconnection from the business of it. What do we get wrong when we talk about sports? What do we get wrong when we look at it as parents, as rising athletes, as coaches? What's the fundamental miss we have?
I think, Bob, and I've really kind of reabsorbed this in my little book tour, is we miss that the goal is to have fun and to make connections with people and to learn things. You know, again, like something I've been citing a lot, and I've been on this book tour for a few months, so the name I keep mentioning is Don Mattingly. And Don Mattingly's role has changed on the duration of my book tour. You know, he started as the Philadelphia Phillies bench coach, and now he's their manager. And, you know, Don Mattingly, to me, is one of the most revered, respected people in the baseball industry that I've ever encountered. And but if you were to discuss his playing accomplishments in a vacuum, what is one of the first things you would say? Probably that he never played in a World Series, right?
Like he was in the Hall of Fame, right?
Not in the Hall of Fame. And part of the reason he's not in the Hall of Fame, arguably, is because he never had to play in a World Series. So, but like Don Mattingly is one of the biggest winners I have ever met because of the way he carries himself, because of the way he treats other people. That's why he's revered within the industry. Yes, there's a rabid Yankees fan base that worships him in large part because he was a tremendous player. But those in the game care less about that and care more about the way he carries himself.
Where do we lose fun? Is it a gradual degradation? Is it happening earlier and earlier? I have a theory.
Well, I mean, as a youth coach myself, once upon a time, I would definitely say the fun is probably taken out by people other than the athlete themselves. I'm sure that's definitely where the start of it is. And was it chapter two you were talking about, Ken? Mm-hmm. You know, about, you know, athletes being like adaptable, resilient, you know, that sort of thing. And I think a lot of times that in this case where the fun stops and it becomes work is probably a third party. It's not an athlete who's starting that losing fun. It's someone else.
Yeah, well, as you know, you can blame the grown-ups 999 out of 1,000 times, right? I mean, that's pretty simple. And I think, look, I just think all these industries exploded, right? Like there's the youth travel circuit and personal coaches, and obviously this is not specific to baseball, softball. This is all the sports, and you know, a lot of ball players now and athletes of all stripes. How do they make a living after they retire? They instruct other athletes. And, you know, there's on one hand, there's a nobility to that. And a lot of these former athletes are really doing really great things and actually speaking against the system. But at the same time, those, they charge a high price, you know, that's affordable to only some.
Yeah, we live not too far from what I would describe as one of the ultimate boutique indoor baseball complexes because it's in a historic Flatiron building in Frozen Ropes at 73rd Street in Columbus and Broadway. It's a remarkable thing that baseball in particular as a sport, softball in the same way, has been taken away from kids in sandlots and given over to kind of the youth sport industrial complex too.
Yeah, I agree.
I wanted to kind of go into this question for you, and you obviously went to a, you worked with a pediatrician on this book to give lessons for parents, for athletes, for coaches to reach them in each of those ways. What was the most surprising to you in this process? What did your co-authors share with you that opened your eyes the most?
Well, it's interesting because my co-author Harley, his perspective was from the grassroots level, right? And my perspective was from the professional level. So it was a nice blending of perspectives. But some of the we have a chapter called "Fake Bunts, White Lies," which I don't remember the name, the number. Let's see if I can. Yep, chapter 22, "Fake Bunts, White Lies," and the idea of, oh, you know. There's it's a detrimental when the kid fakes, you know, shows bunt and then pulls it back and throws off the defense and the pitcher. And what are you really accomplishing there? And just like, what are you accomplishing with a white lie? And I have a son who's now 22. And when I first started working on this with Harley, it was 4 years ago, so he was 18, and he had played Little League and travel ball and for his middle school. So I asked him, like I was taken aback, like, this doesn't really happen this much, does it? So I asked my son, like I fact checked with my son. I said, "Do you remember this being a prominent part of your baseball playing experience?" He said, "Yeah, I do." I said, "Wow, okay. That certainly was not part of mine, you know, many, many decades ago when I played Little League." So yeah, I guess there is that, again, kind of addressing what we've been talking about here, a higher level of competition, which I don't think is good. You know, like what is a 10-year-old doing faking bunt? Like what are you accomplishing?
I mean, you have a whole thing on hidden ball tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I what's if you're gonna play this out into life lessons, what's the trick play that you have run into in your own career that you hadn't seen coming?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, the hidden ball trick is that chapter is written more in the perspective, not really condemning the hidden ball trick, just like be aware of the hidden ball trick. You know, so that's that from that actually Harley used that with his own kids as they grew up, and one of them wanted to buy a used car, and Harley told them, like, be careful the hidden
Yeah.
ball trick, and the kid didn't buy the used car. So there you go. So Jeff, you asked me what like trick play I encountered in my career? Interesting. That's a really good question, and I am struggling to come up with an answer.
We don't like asking bad questions.
But you might have stumped me there.
Well, what
Gosh.
was the first thing that maybe came to mind with that question? Maybe not something that you encountered, but maybe your own experience at some point in your life, or maybe something that you saw with your son when he was going through youth sports.
Not helping, Jeremy.
Did everyone ever steal a story from you, and how did you react?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll share a story. Again, it's tangential, but you guys are pros, and I think it's an interesting story, and we'll go from there. So I had at the very start of my career, I was naive, bordering on stupid, and one early morning, 1997, the Yankees designated for assignment the pitcher David Weathers, whose son Ryan is now pitching for the Yankees. So that's just a sign of how old I'm getting. And David Weathers was like early on a Saturday morning, and not all of the reporters had showed up yet. And I was there, and David Weathers like ripped into George Steinbrenner, and it was like good stuff. You know, it's exactly what you want as a journalist. And I remember like a reporter from one of my competing news, I was with the Bergen Record in Jersey back then, and a reporter from one of the other big papers, I will spare his identity, showed up late and said, "Hey, did I miss anything?" And naive, bordering on stupid Ken Davidoff was like, "Oh yeah, here's what David Weathers said." And the guy's like, "Thanks." And there were other reporters, but then a veteran reporter, it was Jack O'Connell, who's longtime secretary treasurer of the Baseball Writers Association of America, and back then was with the Hartford Courant, took me aside and said, "You realize you just rewarded that guy for showing up late. Like, why did you do that? You know, you you penalized yourself and the rest of us who were there. So I was like, oh, wow, that's a good point. And so I absorbed that lesson. And then fast forward to probably about a year later, I was still doing a little bit of other sports. And the New Jersey Devils had a pretty legendary player, John McLean. And I was like covering, oh, I mean, Jeff, you're a Canada guy. I assume you know every hockey player who's ever lived.
No, but.
So John McLean, you know, Stanley Cup winning forward and like an iconic player. And so I went to like the morning skate before a game, and like John McLean just gathered all the media around and said, yeah, I want to be traded. I've informed the front office I want to be traded. Like, whoa, okay. And I had grown in that time. Like, okay. And I took attendance of who was there. And the Associated Press was not there. And back then, you know, 1998 or so, you know, no one put it on their website. So it was just secret for hours and hours. And then I went later that night at the game, the Associated Press reporter, who I knew a little bit, nice guy, and like he was like, yeah, let me know if you need anything, because he covered more hockey than I did. And I said, thanks, knowing that that day I knew more than he did. And then they showed it on TV. Like, I guess the TV cameras had been there. Like, John McLean has requested a trade. And this guy, the AP guy, said, hey, you need to be on this. Like, this is important. I said, oh, yeah, I've already written that. I know. But thank you. So it was like, you know, there is, like, what's the line? I don't know. What's the line between being too kind and too ruthless, you know? So, but that is something I encountered throughout my career.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up about being kind and being ruthless. For a few years, I was talking
that was
with
be a really good
Billy
question
Bean,
who
used to be with Major League Baseball. Well, we might not be talking about the same Billy Bean. I'm talking about Billy Bean, former baseball player with, what was it, the Tigers, Dodgers, Padres. Yeah. And then he ended up being the MLB's Senior Vice President of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and the Special Assistant to Commissioner. Yeah. And he and I spoke a lot of times over the years, well, not over the years, from probably 2020 to 2024 when he passed. And, you know, one of the things he said was his biggest thing he had to deal with in his role at Major League Baseball was trying to deal with the people that were creating problems for the organization. Normally it was leadership, and, you know, trying to tell them why what they were doing was wrong and why being a nice person may not business-wise make sense, but why it might be the right thing to do. And with, you know, encountering people and talking with the media and stuff. What are your overall thoughts with that, Ken?
Yeah, like, I guess not entirely dissimilar to the story I just told, Jeremy. You have to figure out how to walk that tightrope. Because I do think there has to be some level of accountability and respect for those people doing the work. So yeah, you have to toe that line between not being too nice and not being too mean. And I think a lot of, Joe Girardi was a great baseball mind. And he just, you know, he struggled with communicating with his players and sending a positive, you know, like, I think it's well known, like you, and like, obviously had great success with the Yankees. But I think ultimately the Yankees felt like people just weren't enjoying his leadership, you know, the players. And then he went to the Phillies, and again, like, he came with so much recommended about his knowledge and his leadership qualities, but Joe really struggled to convey how much he cared, in the right way, I guess, to the players. You know, there was an element of tension with Joe, and I think that hurt his managing career.
I have a culture question.
Yeah.
I like to tell the story. As a former New York baseball writer, you will remember Ruben Sierra and mm-hmm. Joe Torre did mm-hmm. not get along. Mm-hmm. You know, Ruben Sierra is another one of those. Could have been fantastic. Mm-hmm. Could have been absolutely phenomenal. Had really great year with the Rangers. You know, really great career. Ends up in New York, and they ended up running him out of town. And I remember at the time, heck, could have been one of your columns. And the worst thing he could say about Joe Torre was, He only cares about winning. And everyone else holding that up as an example of, duh, that's his job, right? It doesn't matter what your feelings are. That's his job to only care about winning. Now that was, I don't know, I'm old. That would have been what, early 2000s,
1996,
late 90s.
96,
Yeah. You talk about, watching the game pass you buy. Do you think that role has changed? Do you think that role has evolved? You see a lot of speculation and talk about success. We talk about junior sports, and obviously, it's not to win. It is to help it, grow future leaders, grow future athletes and stuff. But even at the most elite professional level, now you see situations like, I'll throw give you the hockey example as the Canadian. The head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs gets run out of town because he's, accused of abusing his players. Have we gotten a little too touchy-feely, or is that a good thing?
That's something I had to deal with a lot, Jeff. Those questions and those narratives and storylines. I can't tell you the number of times a Yankees fan would email me and, like, we need to hire Buck Showalter, like bring who is another real old school per like so many fans love Girardi, and again, Girardi did a lot of great things, but like, Girardi held players accountable. Which he did. And but you know yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. And I think Aaron Boone has kind of become the poster boy for what you're saying, because Aaron Boone never calls out, or almost never calls out, anyone publicly. And it's interesting. My former New York Post colleague Joel Sherman and John Heyman, who succeeded me at the Post, and I worked with John at Newsday on Long Island. They host a very entertaining, informative podcast once a week. And there were a couple of years ago, they had on the pitcher Jameson Taillon, who now pitches for the Cubs and pitched for the Yankees for a couple of years. And they asked Taillon about this and about the idea that Aaron Boone never criticizes anybody. And Taillon said, "Look, like, we're watching those press conferences. We're paying attention, and we don't want him to criticize us. He criticizes us behind closed doors, I assure you. He's holding people accountable. But nowadays, this generation of players, like, we don't want to be publicly criticized, And because, again, it's a lot different now because of social media and because of the high speed at which this news travels. It is a lot harder for these players than it was for their forebears, for the Ruben Sierras of the world. So it's interesting. I mean, it's a fair question. I don't know if I have a definitive answer for you. But I do think it's just a much, much different world.
Ken, I want to play off that a little bit. How can you criticize effectively today? Do you get into the idea that, and you've moved over to teaching where at some point you have to grade and give feedback, right? I mean, one of the hardest jobs we have in the world of grade inflation is the debate between the A minus and the B plus right now. It's no longer the C or the D or the F, but and you can't reverse that in one fell swoop. But the idea is, how do you observe effective criticism now, and how can you deliver that well?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bob. And I'm not sure anyone has solved that. And I want to make clear, like, the difference, with all due respect to our Canadian friend Jeff, like, the difference between doing that in New York and, say, Milwaukee or even Toronto is gargantuan. So I do think, like, Aaron Boone and Carlos Mendoza and the Red Sox manager and the Phillies manager have to operate differently than managers of small market teams, or even the, I know Toronto's not a small market, but the media is just different there. I'm not sure anyone has figured that out yet. It's Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? Like, Joe Girardi was too tough, Aaron Boone is too easy. Like, where do we find just right? I don't know if we found just right in 2026.
And the fans want whatever they're not getting in that
Exactly.
way, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
You want
Yes.
They want the one quality that they don't have.
Yes.
Yet in writing the book and pivoting to teaching, in the things that you've done, how do you see the game now differently? The sport as a whole at every level. What's your feeling toward it? What's your attachment?
Well, it's interesting. I've been able to re-embrace it as someone who loves the game because I had kind of lost my love for the game. Somewhat by choice, because I feel like you, when you're covering something, you can't love it because you have to, you know, maybe you uncover the information one day that destroys it and you'd have to cover that. You have to report that information. And on the other hand, I just got sick and tired of watching baseball games. So yeah, now that I'm out, now that I'm off the hamster wheel, I'm able to follow the game pretty closely, go to an occasional ball game as a fan. I'm still incredibly stoic, like watching a game. I have no reaction to anything from my years in the press box. No cheering in the press box, the late Jerome Holtzman. But I'm able to love the game in a way I wasn't, because I can just watch it and enjoy it. And I'm not thinking, what's the column? What's the angle? What inning are we in? I got to figure this out. So just watching it untethered and enjoying it.
That's fantabulous. The idea, I think a lot of us, is that we're too tethered to an outcome or a result or a hope in a lot of ways. You worked through baseball. You came to start writing baseball basically during or right after a work stoppage ended in 95.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You caught collusion.
Yeah.
You got the whole of the performance enhancing drug era.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the scandals as we go. You caught the pitch doctoring. You caught a whole number of ideas.
Sure. Sure.
How do you view the cheating idea? And you moved on to the end of your career. Legalized sports betting was in the offing. How do you see the ethics of the game and where is it today? Where is it around youth sports? What examples are being set?
Well, thankfully, we don't have gambling on youth sports yet.
Yeah.
At least not. But yeah, the gambling, like I just, you know, I wish the commissioners would just admit we had no choice, you know, but to dive into this pool because we need the revenue. You know, there's just, yep. we couldn't pass on this revenue. And any attempt to spin it any other way is laughable. Now, going down to youth sports, I just think, again, it's kind of what we've been talking about, that just my concern is that people are and parents are motivated by the wrong things, you know, by wrong issues. The idea of, okay, my kid's going to get a college scholarship or, you know, or even higher, you know, as opposed to what we talked about, the joys, I think, that should be in the lessons that should be coming out of these games. And I think coaches feel that heat, umpires feel that heat. And I think it's highly, highly unfortunate. And I'm not really sure what can be done to stop it, for the same reason that the commissioners say, we just can't pass on this revenue. There's too much money to be made by this transformation of youth sports, by the specialization, by the elite leagues, elite equipment for that matter.
Just be straight up and tell us you need the money.
Yeah.
We want the money. Yeah. Show us the money. Yeah, just own it.
Yeah.
Ken, you've been very giving of your time. You know, what the average listener is not going to pick up is the tech screw ups that we've been dealing with. You've been very patient with us, and I appreciate it. I'll leave it to Bob to wrap things up. But I did have one question before we wrap up. Obviously, I've written a book. I've co-authored a book, and I know that it's not as easy. It's not as simple as writing half a book. It's actually writing 150% of a book and then fighting. so, what is the one chapter that you and Harley fought over the most?
I guess. I mean, I want to make clear. Like I said, this is Harley's baby, and so like Harley had a full draft written. And then I came in and kind of rolled up my sleeves.
And ruined it.
Yes. And ruined it. You know, it might be, I mean, the fake bunts was up there. But then when my own son, you know, kind of rendered his verdict, you know, then I was like, okay, well, if that's the case.
Yeah.
But I would say in general, the extremely pompous analogy I've been using. Are you fans of the movie, the original Ghostbusters movie with Bill Murray, Dan
Absolutely.
Aykroyd, Harold Ramis? So I don't know if you know how that movie came to be. Dan Aykroyd came up with the idea of the Ghostbusters, fighting these three guys fighting paranormal phenomenon in outer space. And Harold Ramis said, "Let's do it in New York City." And so he
Almost
kind
the
of
same thing.
he kind of grounded it in that way. And I think that was my role with this book. Like I think, from the grassroots level, Harley saw things in a through a more dramatic prism, understandably, because as a pediatrician, he treated young people who for these things felt very dramatic. But my perspective of covering the game at the highest level is, well, maybe we can tone down the drama there a little bit, because in the reality, like these kids are able to move past this and grow up, and at the highest level, this is not really viewed as that dramatic. So that was the kind of yin and the yang of our dynamic. But I can tell you in all sincerity and honesty, like we never had like a real fight. Like there were never any tension or anger. And I think, Harley's a very agreeable gentleman. And also for me, like I told you guys, I was so happy to be writing about this rather than the collective bargaining and the gambling and the collusion and the steroids. That's like, yeah, if you want to disagree about fake bunts, that's a disagreement I can handle.
Ken, you share Donnie Baseball as somebody who carries himself exactly the right way and respects the game in that way. Who is there another most indelible character that you would hold up as an example for parents, for kids, and coaches to kind of emulate?
Yeah, another one who stands out is Hideki Matsui, Godzilla. And he came to the Yankees from the Yomiuri Giants in Tokyo with so much scrutiny and pressure, to the point where there were like 20 reporters who were following him from Japan, like every game. Like it would be like, okay, Yankees win 4-3, but what we really care about is Hideki Matsui went 0 for 2 with a walk, and he caught one fly ball. And they would all interview Matsui after every single game. And he handled that with such diplomacy and forged relationships with the American media, the English-speaking media, and worked, engaged with his teammates, told them, if any of these Japanese reporters ever give you a problem, let me know and I'll handle it. And he just dealt with all that with such grace and diplomacy that he really stands out for me.
Well, we've kept you longer than promised because of my computer woes, but and this has been a wonderful conversation. We hope to have you back on a future episode. We didn't even get into the fact that you're a Hall of Fame voter and that there are issues about that as we go on and the state of things. But I hope as you think about your next project, as you continue in your teaching career and doing all the things that you're doing that are amazing, you'll think about coming back and chatting with us. Our podcast is now absolutely live and available wherever you go to get podcasts at Culture and Sports, our platform, and Leaders Under Fire in Sports. So we're thrilled to have you record our first episode after we've gone live with us, and thrilled to have you with us. And again, I remember you, always will remember you as one of the absolute best in your business and in your trade. And I know you'll bring that same quality to everything. So thank you for today. Thanks for sharing all the things from your new book, and hope that all our listeners will ultimately look for it and read it and take it to heart. Thank you.
101 Lessons from the Dugout. I love it.
Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate your time. This book is available on Amazon. The publisher is Bloomsbury and at select bookstores near you.
You've been listening to Leaders Under Fire in Sports by Culture in Sports. These moments under pressure don't just shape headlines, they shape people. They shape organizations and the cultures they leave behind. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jeff Chatterton, joined with Bob Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and our special guests as we've examined what leadership looks like when it truly matters. If this conversation challenged the way you think about leadership in sports, we invite you to continue to learn with us at cultureinsports.com. Because influencing positive change starts with how leaders respond when they're under fire.